Hi there, and welcome to I'm All Over the Place with Dara Starr Tucker. I'm so glad to have you for this episode that I'm calling The Politics of White Grievance. We're going to get into it, you guys. I wanted to quickly let you know that, yes, this is another episode that was produced for The Breakdown on KJLH in LA. If you're enjoying the consistency of these episodes, let me know by rating the podcast, by leaving a review. I hope you're appreciating getting most of these on Monday mornings at 5 a.m., which is when I make them available. And I want to remind you, too, that the podcast audience always gets a different version of these episodes than the radio audience does. The radio show has to be a tight 25 minutes. There's always a lot of stuff I have to cut out, and it's really painful. So the really cool thing for me is that I don't have to leave all that stuff on the cutting room floor. I just include it for you guys. All sorts of hidden gems are still here intact for my podcast audience, which I love. I want to quickly remind you that we have merch in the Breakdown store that's on my website, darastartucker.com. We also have a Patreon, that's patreon.com/darastartucker. If you want to know how you can consistently support the work that I do, that's one way that you can do that. And then I will also be in Philadelphia at a club called South on the 21st of July, and those tickets are available for purchase on my website at darastartucker.com, or you can go to the South website. The club is called South, and it's in Philadelphia. I have two shows, one at 7 o'clock and one at 9 o'clock, and I would love to see some of my listeners there. So without further ado, let's get on to this episode called The Politics of White Grievance. Thank you so much for listening. Well, hi there, folks. I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. I want to welcome you to this week's show. I'm so glad to be back with you once again, talking about the issues that matter. This is what we do over here. You know, there's nothing wrong with a little fluff and filler here and there. I don't hang out in the deep waters 24/7, and neither should you. We all need a little mindless entertainment from time to time to help us detox from the world. Things can get really intense. They do for me, but it's always good when we can take some time here and there to plug in and contemplate the issues that deeply affect our lives. So that's what I'm here to help you do. So as I let you all know every week, if there are topics that you find stimulating, if you want to have conversation about the kinds of subjects that I'm bringing up here on the radio, we can continue this discussion on the KJLH Instagram page at Radio Free KJLH, or you can find me on my personal Instagram page at Dara Tucker B. And don't forget, KJLH also has an app where you can listen to these shows anytime. You can download that app via your app store, or you can visit the KJLH website to listen to The Breakdown in podcast form. If you need to catch up on past episodes of The Breakdown, you can do that on the website at kjlhradio.com. We've done episodes on voting rights, on cancel culture, on Project 2025, so many important topics. And I've done a few episodes on arts and culture, too. I've covered singers like Nancy Wilson, Roberta Flack, Nina Simone, India Arie, singers who existed in the activism space and who taught us how to couple that activism with art. So those episodes are really worth checking out, too. Now, this week, I want to talk with you about a topic that's not particularly easy to discuss, but it unfortunately seems to have more and more relevance as time goes on. And that's a shame, because you would think we would be past a lot of this stuff in 2024, but alas, we are not. And that topic is white grievance politics. Now, many of you may be able to gather from that title what that generally refers to, but we're going to do a bit of a deep dive this week to really examine what white grievance politics is all about. Where does it come from, and why are we still dealing with this in 2024? Now, I want to make something really clear. This is not an effort on my part to seek out the far right fringes of the political spectrum and go rooting around for the most off-the-wall viewpoints that are being pushed by the YouTube algorithm to 15-year-old boys. And trust me, YouTube is doing a fine job of creating a pipeline for young men to these really dangerous alt-right groups. But I don't want to give voice to any of that. What I'm talking about today are ideas that have become fairly mainstream for a certain group of people. Ideas that you would hear about if you watched Fox News and if you paid attention to the Twitter X feed of the richest man in the world. Ideas that are espoused by the majority of Republican politicians at this point. So what is white grievance politics? White grievance politics really has to do with the fear on the part of some white folks that something has been taken away from them and that it's their job to reclaim that politically. It's the idea that white people, particularly straight white men, are on the decline, and that that decline is happening due to malicious forces that want to annihilate them. So they're feeling an existential threat. Now, for reasons of simplicity, we're going to be speaking about U.S. politics, though this phenomenon certainly has relevance for any majority white country. But here in the U.S., white grievance politics, in my estimation, really dates back to the Civil War. And it speaks to the notion that that war is still being fought in many ways. And this is all rooted in what I would call the first pillar of white grievance politics, and that is white identity. White identity being the false notion that biological race is a reality, and that people can be grouped into separate biological categories that directly relate to skin color and assigned tribes based upon those false groupings. So this idea of racial groupings was implemented on the largest scale in the history of mankind through the transatlantic slave trade. Men and women were taken from the African continent, and they were enslaved based solely on the assertion that it was the divine right of the so-called white race to subdue and dominate the earth and every living being in it, including supposedly inferior races, and most particularly the so-called black race. This is where racism comes from. And there's always been a lot of pseudoscience around this topic, anything to justify the evil that was already in their hearts. If they could use pseudoscience as a justification, they would use that. If they weren't relying on pseudoscience, then they were using scripture as a justification for what they were determined to do. But either way, they had a manifest destiny to conquer and subdue the earth, and they needed black bodies to help them do that. So when the Civil War came and their ancestors were forced to give up their slaves and their economic advantage was undermined, there was lots of resentment. They would suddenly be forced to live and work right alongside the very black people that they had been told were inferior in every way. So as a response, they created Jim Crow laws to create that separation so that they wouldn't have to deal with all that. And that whole separate but equal arrangement, it worked all right for them for a while until the civil rights movement came along and upended everything. And really, that's the era that we're still living in. We're still grappling with the after effects of how the civil rights movement changed the United States, because a lot of the generation that lived through that time is still with us. And a lot of them are the ones really wreaking havoc on any advancement around race in the present day. I mean, let's think about it. We have two presidential candidates, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that were both born before the advent of the modern day civil rights movement. Joe Biden is of the so-called silent generation, and Trump, being born in 1946, is technically a boomer, but really he was born right at the cusp of the silent generation and the boomers. So that pre-civil rights generation, they are still very much in control of the levers of power in this country. But then even considering the boomers who were at the forefront of the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, we have to remember that with any social justice movement like women's rights, workers' rights, the hippies and their anti-war movement, our perception on the back end is that the entire country was pushing for social change. That's what the boomers were all about: burning bras, making love, not war, protesting in the streets, hanging out at Haight-Ashbury, going to Woodstock. But for a large percentage of them, nothing could be further from the truth. With any social movement, there really is just a fringe element of society that pushes things forward for the most part. Probably 15 to 20% of that generation, the boomers at most, was responsible for their reputation as the generation of social change. The rest of them were at home having babies. They were going to their jobs with their short sleeve dress shirts and pocket protectors and not wearing their hair past their collars, and they were following all the rules. If they were white, they were acquiring home loans pretty easily. They were getting up and going to the First Baptist Church on Sunday and then going back to work on Monday morning. That's what they were doing. And then they were coming home at night and watching Archie Bunker or whatever. I mean, it just wasn't all that deep for most of them. So they were observing these social justice movements from afar, from places like Poughkeepsie and Des Moines and Fresno and Tallahassee, and they just continued to live their lives. So most of them have never been all about this radical change. They accepted what the world was when they were young enough to see the possibility of a changed world. And then a lot of them just decided that that was enough. The world was fine just like it was. So anything that came after that was just a bridge too far, and they were not having it. So when we had a couple of immigration acts to be passed, first in 1965 and then again in 1990, demographics slowly but surely started to shift over time. White Christians have become less and less dominant in this country, and we can't fail to acknowledge that a lot of the foreign policy that the U.S. embraced, particularly in the latter part of the 20th century, at the hands of people like Henry Kissinger, who just recently died and was praised by members of both parties as a diplomat and a statesman. But those horrible foreign policies that were pushed by Kissinger and pretty much every U.S. president have led to the destabilization of many, many countries. And because of our deeply problematic foreign policy, a lot of South and Central American countries have experienced untold turmoil domestically. A lot of the crises that we're seeing at the southern border here in the U.S. are directly tied to many of those policies that we've implemented over many, many decades, where we deposed leaders, we armed rebels, we started wars, we colonized lands, we've imposed embargoes. Now, are the leaders of many of those countries also responsible for the greed and the corruption that they have perpetuated? Of course. But has U.S. interference made it exponentially worse for many of the inhabitants of those countries? Without a doubt. So the crisis at the southern border is largely self-imposed. We have a lot to do with why so many migrants are trying to cross that border, because it wasn't always that way. It's just reached the breaking point now. The United States chickens are coming home to roost. People are fleeing war, turmoil, starvation, oppressive regimes, and the lack of economic opportunities, in large part because of the fires that we have started in their home countries. You think these people want to pack up their lives and drag their children hundreds of miles through treacherous terrain and maybe have the chance to enter the U.S. simply because they want to infringe upon what white Americans have? No. They have no choice. But there are many people who see the migrant crisis as something that's being aided and abetted and encouraged by people on the left to artificially inflate their numbers so that they can keep winning elections. A lot of folks on the right really see the influx of these brown people as an existential threat to whiteness itself. And this is exemplified in the second pillar of white grievance politics called the Great Replacement Theory. So we have pillar number one, which is white identity. Now pillar number two, which is the Great Replacement Theory. And if you follow politics, you've probably heard of this. So what is the Great Replacement Theory? Well, this is a theory espoused by a lot of white nationalists that posits that this supposed push towards mass immigration and open borders and the loosening of standards around protecting the border is all rooted in a plot that is deliberately designed to get rid of white people. So you'll hear this pushed in a few ways. They'll talk about immigrants like some sort of invading army. You'll hear a lot of talk like this on Fox News. When Tucker Carlson was on, this was one of his favorite topics. So migrants crossing the southern border are an army that's out to invade America. Or you'll hear them talk, as Elon Musk did in a recent interview with Don Lemon, about voter replacement, that the idea is to bring so many immigrants to the United States that their influence and votes will outnumber the influence and votes of white people. Now, they don't usually say white people because they would get in trouble for that. They'll usually speak about liberals versus conservative views, but they always speak of this immigrant population as being overwhelmingly likely to vote for Democrats, even though these people cannot vote. Or they're driving up population numbers for Democrats, even though most undocumented immigrants are living in red states like Texas and Florida, unless they've been bussed somewhere else by Ron DeSantis. But you'll also hear an anti-Semitic version of the Great Replacement Theory, that Jewish people are behind the whole thing, and that they're really the ones running everything and wiping white people off the planet, that this has been their plan all along. So this is what's behind some of these fringe groups who believe in encouraging white people to have all the children that they can to replenish the numbers, because birth rates for white folks in the U.S. are on the decline. Now, I did a breakdown recently on one of the major purveyors of this Great Replacement Theory, and unfortunately, he is the richest man in the world, Elon Musk. I think it would be hard to argue at this point that that man is not a barely undercover white supremacist. I'm sad to have to say that, but it's true. He doesn't like that label, of course. He doesn't seem to like any labels at all. But if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, We are not afraid to call it a duck around here. So I'm going to play you a breakdown that I did on Elon Musk's history with not so thinly veiled white supremacist rhetoric. Here's the breakdown. Elon Musk is a white supremacist. If you don't know that, you're either not paying attention, you're viewing him through rose-colored glasses because you like him, or you don't know what the definition of a white supremacist is. I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. Don Lemon recently conducted an hour-long interview with the owner of All Things X, and in it, he really drills him about his stance on a variety of issues. Though Musk seems to have a lot to say about race on the platform that he seems hell-bent on destroying, he really didn't seem that eager to discuss his statements on the Great Replacement Theory, the huge spike in right-wing hate speech on his platform, his attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion, or his statements about the supposed woke mind virus. Musk was raised mostly by his father in apartheid South Africa. Apartheid was a system of laws and regulations that governed South Africa from the 50s through the 90s. Apartheid codified racial segregation into law with a strict system of rules that governed the movements of black people. The minority white government controlled where black people lived, where they could work, even where they were allowed to be at certain times. They drove black and colored people off of lands that were designated as whites only, and they created regions called Bantustans where non-white people were forced to live. Black people had their South African citizenship stripped away and they were not allowed to participate in elections. They created educational segregation where each racial grouping had to go to their own schools and colleges, and they made interracial dating and marriage illegal. And the Indemnity Act of 1961 made it legal for police officers to commit acts of violence and to torture and kill people with total impunity. So that's the environment that Musk grew up in. It would have been nearly impossible for him to have any close friends or associates who were black or brown. He was taught that black and brown people were inferior to the point that a whole system of laws had to be created to keep him separate from them. And this clearly informs a lot of the ideas that he embraces now that he's become the richest man in the world. You would think that someone like him would have taken advantage of the opportunity to expand his worldview over time, but he seems to be growing more and more entrenched in his provincial mindset where race is concerned. All this makes you wonder what his upbringing must have been like. Well, we're getting more glimpses into the factors that shaped him as time goes on. In that interview with Don Lemon, he attempts to distance himself from conspiracies like the Great Replacement Theory. He's not happy to be answering a lot of Don's questions around these topics, but he's getting through the interview okay. But towards the end, Don asks Elon why he blames advertisers for bringing down the value of X, when, as Don points out, Musk himself should be ultimately held responsible for this decline, since he insists on making his controversial viewpoints known. It's at this point that Musk grows visibly uncomfortable and starts saying he needs to leave, and then he sort of blurts this out unexpectedly.
And I had a tough childhood.
Elon Musk has given a few vague insights into what this difficult childhood was like in past interviews. As a child on the spectrum, he was bullied endlessly. After his parents broke up when he was 8, he chose to stay with his father in Pretoria, South Africa. He later said that this was a mistake. His father, Errol Musk, is an engineer turned real estate developer who married and had children with his stepdaughter. He was reportedly abusive to Musk's mother, and he treated Elon and his siblings horribly. In a 2017 interview with the Rolling Stone, Elon Musk describes his father as a terrible human being. But one thing Elon seems to have in common with that terrible human being is the belief that if he and others like him don't commit themselves to having as many children as possible, there will be a total civilization collapse. 78-year-old Errol Musk is the father of 7 children, 3 with Elon's mother, May, 2 with his ex-wife, and 2 more with her daughter. His youngest is just 2 years old. He says that men need to be having as many children as possible, and that if he could find another woman under 35, he'd happily have more children. This echoes what seems to be Elon's philosophy around single-handedly repopulating the Earth. Elon, who has 10 children that we know of, has made no secret of the fact that he feels that people aren't having enough children. But not just anyone should be having children, in his estimation. According to him, too many good, smart people have been told that the population growth is out of control and they aren't having enough babies. And while the world's overall population is not growing nearly at the rate that it was during the population boom of the 20th century, the idea that this represents an imminent risk to society is completely unfounded. The truth is that while the population in places like Europe, South Korea, and Japan are rapidly declining, the population in sub-Saharan Africa will almost double by 2050. India's population will grow by over 250 million people in that time. They'll eventually surpass China as the most densely populated country in the world. So it's not that people aren't having enough children, it's that the right people aren't having enough children, according to Musk. This all goes back to something called the Great Replacement Theory that's repeated often by members of the far right. It used to be a fringe theory, but thanks to folks like Tucker Carlson and platforms like Elon's Twitter X, the theory is being mainstreamed quickly. It all rests on the idea that immigration policies are intentionally being loosened to facilitate the browning of traditionally white countries. Proponents of this conspiracy theory will often use language that refers to undocumented immigrants as invaders and broadly cast them as criminals who must be feared and driven out. A quick perusal of Musk's X feed shows you just how much time he apparently spends thinking about how brown the country that he immigrated to is becoming. When he's not boasting about how his companies are supposedly saving the world, he's reminding you that the illegals are invading in record numbers and must be stopped, at the same time that he's warning against dwindling population numbers and telling all the smart people to have more children. Yeah, something's not adding up. Now, there's no doubt that his right-wing political leanings have a lot to do with his fear of the wrong kind of people becoming a majority in this country. The video that he recently pinned to the top of his Twitter X account lays this out with just the right amounts of alarmism and disinformation. But to attempt to separate the political fears from the racial ones is really a fool's errand. The political aims that people like Tucker Carlson and Elon Musk are trying to preserve are inextricably tied to their beliefs around the superiority of white people. And of course, their concerns about preserving the patriarchy, heteronormativity, and national identity are wrapped up in there as well. For further insight into Musk's views on the outdated eugenics theory, I would suggest watching a video produced by my friend Garrison Hayes for Mother Jones Magazine called "Elon Musk Keeps Spreading a Very Specific Kind of Racism." All of the indicators for Elon Musk's very obvious white supremacist views are right there in plain sight. He's made his platform into a safe haven where like-minded people have felt free to gather and affirm each other's views while sending the reports of hate speech on that platform up to 3 times what it was before he took over. He recently sued the watchdog company that reported on this and lost. But it's important to be able to recognize and call out white supremacist ideals wherever they appear, regardless of how they may be repackaged, reworded, or reframed for a new generation. And it's important to expose them for what they truly are, regardless of how rich and powerful the people disseminating those ideals are. So he's accomplished his goal of making Twitter X a haven for these people. He calls any efforts at content moderation censorship, and he says he feels like the app was suppressing far too many right-wing folks. So he's rectifying that, according to him. Now, the third pillar of white grievance politics is what I would call white backlash to black progress. And you could basically say that the whole Trump phenomenon is evidence of this. Trump really would not have been taken seriously had it not been for Barack Obama's presidency. I'm remembering a White House correspondents' dinner in maybe 2011 where Barack Obama roasted Trump in front of the entire room. And just the idea that this tuxedoed black man who had risen to the highest office in the land could sit there and roast him like he did. A lot of people feel that that's when Trump began to take the idea of running for president seriously. The United States was riding high after electing a black president in 08, and folks were high-fiving themselves. You saw think pieces being written about a post-racial America. America was really feeling itself, but it didn't take long before the backlash hit, and a bunch of folks ended up with buyer's remorse, mainly spurred on by Obama's push to get the Affordable Care Act signed into law. The Affordable Care Act was something that many, many Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, had tried to make happen for years. And Obama was the one to get it done, but it cost him a huge amount of political capital. And suddenly you had Fox News and so many other conservative outlets accusing him of setting up death panels and bringing communism to the United States. You would have thought that this man had pledged his soul to Satan in Times Square. They completely eviscerated him for this. And suddenly he was not the golden boy anymore. And that was 2010. And of course, 2011, 2012 rolls around. Trump starts launching all of these attacks about Obama's birth certificate and questioning his citizenship, basically casting Obama as the cultural other in many people's minds and setting Trump up to launch his campaign as the country's white savior in 2016. The epitome of white backlash to black progress. I will never forget a video that the satirical website The Onion put out right after the 2020 re-election of Barack Obama. It's one of my favorite Onion stories of all time. Now, The Onion is a site, of course, that does political satire, and they really nailed this one. It described perfectly what the timber of the country was right around this time. So I'm going to play that for you now. Remember, this is satire. Here's The Onion piece on the re-election of Barack Obama.
Just yesterday, Barack Obama was re-elected to a second term as president, but that doesn't mean it's too early to start looking ahead at potential GOP candidates for 2016. Some experts say a frontrunner has already emerged in the form of this shrieking white-hot sphere of pure rage. The sphere seen here decimating homes in a small Maryland town is testing through the roof with conservatives who were disappointed with Obama's victory last night. Jason Copeland, why is this thing so popular?
Well, Andrea, look, this screaming orb just might be the only one who really taps into the deep-seated seething fury felt by so many Republicans right now.
That's true.
This thing is young, it's exciting, it feeds off fear and terror. It's no wonder conservatives are raving about it.
Mitt Romney just didn't get me fired up enough to vote. But that sphere of anger really speaks to me, usually through my television or in my nightmares. It's got me building this hive.
Now, we know the thing is popular, but does this rage sphere actually want to run for president?
Well, Andrea, it hasn't said no. I mean, when interviewed, the howling conservative plasma orb reportedly said, quote, a loud whirring sound, some unintelligible shrieks, bow before me, more piercing violent shrieks, guns, not our America. And then it just repeated faggots at a deafening pitch for hours and hours.
Okay, but that sounds pretty noncommittal,
well,
Jason.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, you know, if Republicans want this thing to run, they're going to have to find some way to trap it, communicate with
absolutely.
It, steer it in the right direction. Some conservative leaders have already begun offering sacrifices of virgins and livestock,
okay.
which is a good first step, obviously.
And Jason,
so,
now,
I mean,
we are getting some breaking news right now that the sphere is making further political inroads. Apparently, Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina has just an hour ago resigned his seat in the Senate to the beast. In an official statement that we have here, Burr said, quote, it will do better than I ever could. Nowhere to run. Lead me to my end. I am worthless. It owns us. That's a quote,
big,
Jason.
Big development there.
Yeah, so grows the orb. Now, Jason, is it too soon to speculate as to who the sphere might pick as its running mate?
Well, I can't see the sphere picking anyone other than the dark, ominous cloud of racism that the Republicans love so much.
Oh, right. I mean, it's been around for years. It has experience.
And if the party gets serious about its ground game in Iowa and the maelstrom's able to maintain cohesion without exploding and exterminating life on this planet, I think we can expect the announcement of a white hot sphere, horrible lurking fog ticket as early as Christmas 2015.
Thank you, Jason. Later in the hour, we'll take an in-depth look at some early frontrunners for the Democrats, including Joe Biden, Martin O'Malley, and the magical arc of empty promises.
Hilariously accurate, unfortunately. So, of course, in addition to Trump, we've seen a whole slew of far-right candidates elected to all sorts of political offices. In my home state of Oklahoma, in a city called Enid, they just oopsie, elected an avowed white nationalist to the city council. This guy's name is Judd Blevins, and he was at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. And he also has ties to a white supremacist group called Identity Europa. And when the committee that was investigating him asked him why he attended that Charlottesville rally and why he was a part of this white nationalist group, he said it was because he wanted to, and this is a quote, he wanted to bring attention to the same issues that got Donald Trump elected in 2016, securing America's borders, reforming our legal immigration system, and according to him, quite frankly, pushing back on this anti-white hatred that is so common in media and entertainment. So now that he's come to national attention, I'm sure there's going to be some like-minded folks that will find something for this guy to do. He's probably going to become a right-wing lobbyist, if I know that sect. So what are the dangers here? I mean, we know this kind of thing is generally looked down upon, or it used to be, but what are the dangers of these kinds of views being mainstreamed? What are the dangers of white grievance politics? Well, this has had real-world consequences. I mentioned that Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, where a bunch of aggrieved, mostly young white men walked through the streets of downtown Charlottesville, Virginia, chanting, "The Jews will not replace us," while brandishing tiki torches. The only thing I can respect about that group is that they had their faces in full view. We know who they are. There was a white nationalist march in downtown Nashville, where I used to live, a few weeks ago, and they covered up their faces, which, in my opinion, is just as cowardly as their Klan predecessors. But you'll see this theme of the Great Replacement Theory pop up again and again in racially motivated violence. There was a mass shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018 where the shooter referenced the Great Replacement Theory. He said that HIAS, which is a Jewish American nonprofit that assists refugees, he said they were conspiring to bring invaders that kill our people. That was his quote. So again, he's repeating this language that Trump and others have used about immigrants being rapists and murderers, interlopers. There was a mass shooting at multiple mosques in 2019 in New Zealand where 51 people were killed. The manifesto of that shooter was literally called the Great Replacement. And again, in 2019, 23 people at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas were killed. They were targeted because they were Latino. And this guy's manifesto referenced the Great Replacement, and he talked about an Hispanic invasion of Texas, which tells you these people don't know their history, because in truth, there has been a white invasion of Texas. It was stolen from Mexico, but look, I digress. So how can we combat all of this? You know, I like to talk about some positive action that we can take to address these issues. Well, I'm going to reference an action list from a site called immigrationreform.org. And they have a few really good suggestions. Firstly, we can learn more about our history. If you are an auditory or visual learner like I am, I would suggest following a couple of creators on YouTube that do some really good explainer videos that can help you get your head around some complex historical info, like our immigration policy and the U.S.'s fraught foreign policy history. I would suggest following a creator named Johnny Harris, who covers lots of geopolitical issues, and he communicates the basics of U.S. and world history in a way that's really entertaining and easy to understand. If you want to learn more about things like the scramble for Africa or the U.S.'s history of broken treaties with Native Americans or how the U.S. ended up swiping Texas right out from underneath Mexico, as I referenced earlier, I would suggest following Johnny Harris. You'll leave smarter than when you came. And I would also suggest following a publication called Vox. They do similar work. That's V-O-X. And they do these 5 to 10 minute explainers on lots of political and cultural topics with stellar graphics. If you're a history junkie like I am, you will get hooked on this stuff. Secondly, you can spread the word. Help others to understand things like the Great Replacement Theory. A lot of people who follow Elon Musk and people like that, they don't necessarily know where these ideas come from. It all sounds new and fresh to a lot of them, and they don't really know to be on the lookout for these dangerous ideas. So be ready to have these conversations. Thirdly, we need to be amplifying creators who are talking about this stuff. If you happen to see that explainer that I did on Elon Musk's white supremacy, give it a like or a comment. If you see Garrison Hayes' video on Elon Musk, like it and comment on it. Put it in your stories, whatever. Any content that you see that helps people better understand what a dangerous road a lot of these folks are going down, amplify that. Think of ways that you can bring light to that. Fourthly, if you encounter someone spouting these beliefs, challenge them. Ask them where their data comes from. And of course, that's after you've educated yourself around it, but challenge them on those beliefs. And fifth, get involved in work that supports immigrants. Immigrationreform.org has a whole advocacy resources landing page that shows you ways that you can get involved with pushing back against some of this anti-immigrant rhetoric and fervor. Well, that is my time. Thank you so much for checking out the breakdown this week. I hope you came away with some information that you can use. It's sad that we have to continue to be on the lookout for this kind of thing in 2024, but we are going to continue to arm ourselves with knowledge and push back against the forces of evil in this world. My name is Dara Starr Tucker, and as always, you can find me at the KJLH Instagram page, Radio Free KJLH on Instagram. You can also find me on my personal page, Dara Tucker B. You can find me on all other platforms at Dara Starr Tucker. That's Dara with one R and Star with two. So let's keep arming ourselves with the truth. I look forward to doing this again next week, same time, same place. And until then, let's learn to shout.